You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey, y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 83. The last show was all about free or nearly free things to do in New Orleans. I get asked variations of the question all the time, and it turns out there's a lot of things that meet that criteria. We covered at least 52 things that are free or cost less than $6. Everything from festivals to streetcars to enjoying life along the Mississippi River. If you missed it, be sure to go back and give it a listen. I know you'll enjoy it. For today's episode, I have a special guest. She's a fellow podcaster, but that doesn't begin to do justice to her work. Her previous show, Tripod, was voted best radio show in New Orleans in 2017 at the New Orleans Press Club Awards. It also won numerous regional Edward R. Murrow Awards for her work on Haiti, which we'll talk about. Her newest podcast, Sticky Wicket, is all about clashes between Louisiana politicians and the media. She's a freelance journalist for national radio and print outlets, including NPR, Marketplace, and Here and Now, and other podcasts, including one of my favorites, Death, Sex, and Money. Welcome to the show, Lane Kaplan-Levinson. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
It is so good to finally meet in person.
I know, after a lot of digital communication.
Right. We were just talking. We first communicated before you went to Haiti, which was a year and a half ago, probably.
Yeah.
And we'll get into that. I wanted to mention that you and I are recording today from the private dining room at Grigri.
Yes.
Grigri is a great restaurant located at 1800 Magazine Street in the Lower Garden District. It opened in 2018, and it's received a lot of reviews, but I love the food here, Lane. The gumbo is particularly good. It's not kind of dark and smoky. It's got a different flavor to it. Plus, they have great shrimp and grits and really just the whole menu. So I wanted an opportunity to highlight what Chef Eric Cook and the team here do. So when I was looking for a place for you and I to meet, this seemed like a great one. So if you're listening, come check it out sometime. And when we're done, I'm going to have a cup of gumbo. Hey, before we jump in, we're in the Lower Garden District. And have you ever been on a walking tour of the Garden District?
No, I actually haven't.
So you should do that, Lane. One of our sponsors is Two Chicks Walking Tours. Christine Miller owns it, and she happens to be a good friend, but it's a cool, cool tour. You can go, they have a couple tours, but the one that I like, that I've been on recently, is the Garden District tour. And what's cool about it is you not only get to explore the Garden District, you get to hear about past residents like Anne Rice, current residents like John Goodman, but you hear all the stories and you learn about the architecture. Plus, as you know and have talked about on your show, one of the many things that makes New Orleans unique are our cemeteries, and you get a little taste of that. You get to go to Lafayette Cemetery right in the heart of the Garden District, and I bring it up because we're in the Lower Garden District right now. So it's a really fun tour. You get to learn something. You get to have a good time. They also have other tours of the French Quarter and St. Louis No. 1, but whatever you choose, know you're going to be in great hands with my friend Christine, and you're going to have a wonderful time. If you use code BEYOND, you'll save 15% over at twochickswalkingtours.com. So with that, I kind of want to just jump in.
Let's do it.
All right. So there's so much. But first, let's talk about something you don't talk about on your podcast much, a little about you.
Me?
Yeah. And I know as a podcaster, it's the last thing you want to talk about.
It is always interesting to be interviewed. And I actually think good practice as someone who's usually doing the interviewing because it reminds you of what it's like on the other side.
I agree.
Yeah.
So what's your backstory? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York, outside of New York City in Westchester County. Mm-hmm. I'm originally from Staten Island, which is often the forgotten borough of New York City. And I lived there as a kid, and then we moved to the suburbs when I was in elementary school. Grew up there, went to high school there. Had a great public education there, and then went to college outside Boston at Brandeis University. Mm-hmm. Majored in American studies and film, which actually kind of, you know, all these years later, not that many years later, but kind of all these years later at this point, shows this, there's this like closing of the loop of what I studied in school and what I ended up doing, which is interesting. Because I didn't study journalism or communications.
Sure.
And then I moved here in 2009, so it's almost my 10th anniversary, wow. which is pretty wild. And I moved here just from meeting a friend in college who was from New Orleans and said, you know, when we graduate, I'm going to go back home because it's the greatest place to live. And I was really interested in living somewhere else and not immediately returning to New York, where I thought, you know, I would stay forever and have like a very singular understanding of the country and the world. And New Orleans seemed like a place where I could go and live and find work to do and continue to learn about myself and, more importantly, learn about a different part of the country and how things work outside of this, you know, East Coast mentality. And 10 years later...
That happens here in New
Orleans. I'm sold. Yeah.
And that's not an altogether unusual pattern coming from the Northeast. A lot of people come to Tulane, obviously, fall in love with the culture and stay. I can see the similarities here. And certainly what you've done with your film background, although that's not what you do today, but it's so much similar in a lot of ways, I think, about telling stories.
It's really similar, especially if you think about documentary work, which is what I do, the type of podcast that I have and the radio that I make. I discovered editing sound and audio through learning film and then delving, you know, beyond film critique into the technical aspects is when I kind of realized, oh, wow, I, you know, have a pretty short attention span. And yet for some reason, I can sit here and edit for a really long time. So that must mean something.
And I read an interesting story about you sort of, it seemed like you were really interested, but in some ways kind of fell into it a little bit because it wasn't your background and maybe what you thought you would do, right?
Totally. Yeah, I never really considered journalism, but I was always interested in storytelling. So I think, you know, my being drawn to film was always this draw to story and to narrative and to people, honestly. And so I also loved music. So there was this kind of sonic element and then this narrative element. And that, for me at the time, that was through like studying film and having a radio show, you know, where right. I DJed and played my favorite music of the week. But I didn't really know, you know, what that would turn into. It is funny, though. My mom has this story now where she says, I don't even remember this, but I believe her because it's deprecating and she wouldn't say it if it wasn't true. But she says that at some point, someone asked me in high school, you know, what that classic question, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, you know, I think I want to work for NPR. And my mom was like, good luck, you know, like, good luck, Lane. And so now she's always just like, I'm so sorry I said that because I work at NPR. So there was something back then that thought I would figure out a way to tell stories without necessarily needing to go the hard journalism, hard reporting beat route.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's a good segue to, and I most of our listeners have probably heard of Tripod and Sticky Wicket, and we will certainly get into that. But before that, you did the whole Bring Your Own. Can we talk a little bit about how did that come? First, for listeners, let's tell them what was or what is Bring Your Own.
Yeah, so Bring Your Own, it's on hiatus, so it's still, I still do it, but I've taken a almost year break.
Sure.
Mostly because of Sticky Wicket, which I think was worth it. But, you know, going back to this idea of story, Bring Your Own is a live storytelling event where every event partners with a community organization, and the theme of the evening is related to the work of that organization. So people will get up in front of a live audience. They're not performers by trade. It's often the first time they're ever getting on a stage. And they're telling a true story about their life that's related to some theme. And so, for instance, you know, we've partnered with a real range of organizations from like the New Orleans Museum of Art to the Fair Housing Action Center. So sometimes there's more of like a justice bend and sometimes there's more of an arts bend. And we record those stories because I record everything and produce them to stream as a podcast and also air on WWNO.
I think it's a fabulous thing. I have anxiously been awaiting for it to come off hiatus. And by the way, I should mention, we'll put links to all the things we talk about in the show notes for today, which will be over at beyondbourbonst.com/83. But it's one of those things that I venture to say most people that listen are listening haven't heard of. And if you're here in New Orleans or you're visiting, at the very least, you can sign up for the newsletter so that you'll know the next time you guys pull that back. Totally. But I love that you can go on your website there and look at the past ones and listen to them.
Yeah, yeah. All the stories that we produce for air also go up on the site. And it's a nice way, you know, I'm really into this kind of multi-platform, you know, doing something and having it accessible to whoever consumes media in a certain way. So if you're a podcast listener,
sure,
you know, you can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. If you listen to the radio, it's going to also have like a terrestrial feed. And then if you're someone who's like online and, you know, searching the web, it's all there too. So I just think it's nice at a time when the digital age is becoming so all-consuming and swallowing things up, I think it's important to continue to have content available, you know, on multiple platforms.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure. And that's a kind of, again, a nice segue to Tripod. So your first big podcast, Tripod New Orleans at 300. Let's talk a little bit about how that came about. And then I'm going to jump a little in, like the very last episode sort of blew my mind about the whole series.
Yeah.
which we'll talk about in a moment. But so how did the idea of Tripod come about?
So I was at the station working as an environmental reporter. So this whole idea
WWNO,
that...
WWNO, I'm
at,
sorry.
Yes, mentioned yes. That. So I work at WWNO, the local NPR station. I was covering the Louisiana coast and the land loss crisis in Southeast Louisiana. And I thought I was going to keep doing that. And then my boss said, you know, we have this other opportunity. We don't really know what it's going to be, but we, you know, we're going to do some type of history related project and it's going to air and it's kind of about the tricentennial, but kind of not. And we haven't designed it at all. You probably don't want to do that, right? And to be honest, I thought to myself, okay, a history segment on public radio, like this could be so lame. Like this could easily just be so boring and bad. And you can phone stuff like that in, right?
Sure.
You bring in a historian, you bring in an academic, you sit down, you talk about a topic, they wrote some article for something and you're asking. And that's a cheap way to do it, financially.
Sure.
But I thought, you know, this is a challenge because this could be really bad, and if it's good, it will be really good. Mm-hmm. And you know, going back to my background, I studied history,
right?
And I was always more interested in documentary than in hard news. So here was what I saw as an opportunity to kind of make that lateral shift at WWNO, and take this idea that wasn't named anything yet, that wasn't fleshed out, that didn't have a length of episode, and say, this is documentary content. This is a documentary show. And so I took that job and called it Tripod because it was a tricentennial podcast. Mm-hmm. But then there's kind of this meta meaning of a tripod, as you know, you and I both are kind of using right now, right, as we record, as this thing to assist in capturing a moment or a story or a visual or a sound. And so Tripod is, you know, an actual documentary tool, and it's also this kind of abbreviation of tricentennial podcast.
Sure, sure. And it seemed to me, although it was a ton of work, I'm sure it seemed like the fun you all were having came out in the recordings of it. Is that a fair?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that worked about it is that I didn't go into being the host of the show as a New Orleans history expert. Mm-hmm. And the downside was that it took some trust building with some people being like, why are you hosting this? You're sure not a historian. And me being like, great point. But the plus side that I think, you know, won out in the end is that I was learning these things for the first time. And so that enthusiasm or mm-hmm. that surprise or that curiosity that I brought was completely genuine because I was learning it with the audience. Right. And it wasn't this top-down approach. It was kind of like, hey, I'm going to go figure all this stuff out and learn these really wild stories about the past that have been, you know, unintentionally or intentionally shelved. And if you come with me, you're also going to learn it too. I'm not telling you anything. We're just figuring this out together.
I think one of the funnest things about being a podcaster focused on New Orleans is that you get to take your curiosity and dive in and take everyone along with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and that does mean though that you're not the expert in most of the stuff, right?
Right. You're talking to experts.
But it did strike me. You guys had some partners. You had the Historic New Orleans Collection and the Midlow Center out at UNO.
Yeah.
So you're talking about, right, you're going into a situation where clearly there are experts around you.
Exactly. And I couldn't have done it without them.
Right. They're both great. We've done a couple episodes with the Historic New Orleans Collection. And after, for me, getting over the intimidation of walking in the door, they're so excited to tell their story about whatever topic it might be and so knowledgeable. But you're right. The challenge is to bring that to life for someone who's not a history major or super geeked out on history, right?
Yeah, exactly. Kind of turning history into pop history without trivializing it or watering it down in any way, and just finding a way to package the story so that it's intriguing but still complex and complicated and true.
Well, and you guys dove into quite a range. I don't know how many episodes was it total?
Do you 66.
Know? 66. And it started in 2015?
Yeah.
October, I think.
Yeah.
If I remember right?
Yeah, it did. October 1st.
And you guys hit quite a range of topics. I mean, off the top of my head, the wood screw was interesting.
Yeah.
People have to go back and give that a listen. I love the story about Henriette DeLisle.
Mm-hmm.
That's another one. And is it the Little Sisters of Charity? Little Sisters of the
Sisters of the Holy Family.
Holy Family.
Yeah.
And that story, that hit me walking in here. There's a sort of a, in this room we're in right now, there's a bit of an ode to Grigri, of course, and voodoo. When I walked in, there's actually a little drawing of Marie Laveau, but it made me think about that episode. And then you guys, you ended up doing like this kind of mini documentary within it on Haiti. How did that come about?
So the episodes are short docs. They're mini docs, right? So they're between 10 and 20 minutes long. And we did that strategically so that the show could air during Morning Edition on NPR when, you know, if kind of like the industry term is drive time.
Sure.
So when you get something that's airing during Morning Edition, you're automatically getting just tens of thousands of people that are going to hear it. Mm-hmm. So that was important to us. You know, I originally thought, well, I want to have a half an hour show, you know, which I then got because that I did want a half an hour show. Right. But I definitely saw the value of having a shorter show that could fit into that Morning Edition slot. Mm. So the typical tripod episode, if you go back and you can still find the whole archive, those are 10, 15, 20 minute episodes.
Right.
As I was doing the show and learning about New Orleans and learning about its history, something that kept coming up in various forms was this historic relationship that New Orleans has to Haiti, mm-hmm. To the island nation of Haiti. And so there were a lot of like epiphanies and realizations that I was having, including like, wow, why didn't I ever learn about the Haitian Revolution? Mm-hmm. This is one of the most important, if not the most important revolution of all time. Pretty much the only successful rebellion of enslaved people in the Americas, where they gained independence and formed their own country. Why didn't I learn about that in school? There's obvious reasons that we don't learn about that in school, but it just kind of made me angry and reinforced this idea of what I wanted Tripod to be, which was a place that filled in the gaps of things that you maybe didn't learn and people didn't want you to learn. And that even, you know, the tourism industry here doesn't promote mm-hmm. for specific reasons. Tripod was going to go to those places and tell those stories because there was a necessity for them. They weren't being told otherwise in mainstream media. Mm-hmm. So I decided that this relationship, I thought about the fact that this relationship between New Orleans and Haiti was so significant and was in some ways this foundation for the whole show. You know, this relationship started in the early at the very end of the 18th century in the 1790s. So this was before New Orleans was even an American territory. Mm-hmm. All of these people from the colony of Saint-Domingue, which is now what Haiti is, came into this country after the revolution. And then there was another influx later on. There was a time in this city where a third of the population was from Haiti. And I think that in a lot of ways, that's still kind of true. There's so many people that are of Haitian descent in New Orleans that both know it and don't know it, which is fascinating. So to wrap this up, I wanted to do a special project within the series itself, and knowing that it was a 3-year project that would end at the end of the tricentennial year, what's something that we could do that would make a big splash within the program that we could kind of have as this kickoff to the final season? Mm. And I thought, well, what if I went to Haiti? Because I'm hearing about it constantly in my pursuit of learning about this place, and I wonder if I went there, they would talk about New Orleans. Like it just really made me think, like, we think about you. Do you think about us? Like, we're constantly talking about you. Do you talk about us? Is this a mutual situation here? Or is this like a one-sided, siphoning type of relationship? So I got a small grant from Tulane University, from the Tulane Center for the Gulf South, and that funded a reporting trip where I went to Haiti for 2 weeks and essentially asked that question, does New Orleans matter to you? Do you know about this relationship? Is this a thing that impacts your life now? And I came back and produced an hour-long radio documentary that's called Is the Feeling Mutual? That's all about this relationship and the relevance of that relationship today in both territories.
I thought it was fascinating to listen to it through the podcast. And then you were also interviewed, I think, at one point by a co-host or another host at WWNO about your experience.
Yeah,
we'll get all the links to that and we'll put it in the show notes. But to me, it sort of struck me on a very simple level of you're in a relationship and the relationship ends and one person like thinks all about the other person and that other person is sort of like, eh, moves on, right?
Yeah, totally.
What maybe surprised you the most about that trip?
The trip changed my life. It was really an incredible experience to go to a place that did in so many ways feel so similar. Hmm. Was very striking. I think, it's true. When you go, if you have the opportunity to travel to the Caribbean, many parts of the Caribbean really do feel similar to New Orleans, which, is often referred to as the northernmost point of the Caribbean. And so walking around sometimes just feeling like I was tripping, am I in the French Quarter? This is insane. Or, driving by all the shotgun houses and hearing the music, all of that cultural stuff and visual aesthetics, that really is very similar. The architecture, mm-hmm. elements of the food, the music, it's striking. And then at the same time, what the biggest takeaway that I had from that trip is that when I asked, no matter who I asked, an architect, a historian, a musician, a teacher, a government official, someone in the tourism industry, whenever I asked, what is the deal with New Orleans and Haiti? Is the feeling mutual? What happened? Their response was, yes, we know that we had this historic relationship. Yes, this mattered to us. But no, we don't have it anymore. We're not tied anymore. And it's interesting that you, New Orleans, are talking about us all the time and still kind of giving us a nod to this culture that you profit off of. But we're not really reaping any benefits of that. We don't see lines of communication open. And people told me over and over again, this is actually a metaphor for our relationship to much of the world, which is that we've had these ties, we were this thing, and we've been kind of pushed out for mm-hmm. X, Y, and Z reason. And New Orleans, yeah, we know that we're kind of like you, but right now we don't feel that much differently than we do with many countries that have forgotten about us. And so that to me felt like an important, again, kind of proof of concept of doing this documentary and having people hear that and think like, Yeah. Okay. What can we do to re-strengthen these ties, to reconnect these places that have a lot to learn and benefit from each other?
I thought it was so interesting consuming it and thinking about that's very much how New Orleans or New Orleanians often feel too, right? When you think about post-Katrina and then along the Gulf Coast with the BP oil spill and the things you used to cover, right? The land loss and the, it feels like here in New Orleans and in Louisiana, there's always a bit of a chip on our shoulder about, don't forget we're part of the United States and, you know, the whole, should you rebuild below sea level and that whole narrative, certainly different than Haiti, obviously. But as I listened to you in that show, I was hit on many levels, and that was one of them. Mm. That boy, there, from our view, there's still this kind of similarity to that, right?
Totally, totally. And you know, we have Katrina, unfortunately, and they have the earthquake of 2010, and it's that same thing of like, you know, who was there for us. And, you know, I just learned through my reporting with Sticky Wicket, you know, much more about the disaster that came with the disaster of Katrina and the political blame game and all the ways that people didn't just start working and helping. And I think, you know, there are reasons for that. And Haiti feels the same way. The one difference, though, is that New Orleans has a really great brand, and New Orleans gets 18 million tourists a year, despite, you know, the realities of violence, gun violence, you know, there's a gun violence, natural disasters, you know, we have all these things that would make it a place that people would feel hesitant to travel to. And yet we have such a great marketing plan that we get so many tourists. Whereas Haiti has all of that too, when it comes to, you know, a degree of violence, a degree of natural disasters, and then like incredible food, music, architecture, beaches, like way better beaches than, right, you know, we don't have. And yet there's no booming tourism industry. And so what's that about? What are we doing and what are we able to accomplish and present to the world to bring in that money and to bring in those visitors? And why is that not the case for Haiti? And if that was, what harm would that cause too? Like, what are, you know, New Orleans does pay a price for the degree of tourism that we bring in. And there's, you know, it's a blessing and a curse. And so all of that came up in this reporting, and I still think about all of that stuff to this day.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful reporting. It's wonderful to listen to. Again, we'll put the links to WWNO and all the ways you can get to the podcast and the reporting over at beyondbourbonst.com/83. I want to jump to Sticky Wicket, but I don't want to leave quite yet Tripod, because the very last episode, and I only listened to it recently, all of a sudden you dropped this word bolbancha. I hope I'm saying that correctly.
You are.
and I don't know how much I want to give away, because I want people to go listen to it. But your very last episode, I imagine, had to be sort of bittersweet. And then you dropped this sort of like, this word bolbancha. So bolbancha, why don't you explain what it is?
Okay. So bolbancha is a word that I recently learned. So if you don't know what it is, don't feel bad. Even though we should all feel bad.
I had to like stop the car. I was like, what? I'm a podcaster about New Orleans. Yeah. I'm a native New Orleanian. Well, you know, New Orleanian, not right. Bolbanchan, I guess.
Right, right. Yeah, it puts a whole nother definition of that term. So bolbancha is the indigenous term and name of what this place was called before it was colonized and called New Orleans. So, you know, whether or not it was an actual city, there were, as most people listening know, there were many, many people here before Europeans arrived, Native and Indigenous people that had been here for thousands of years. And they had names for things, as we see, you know, all over town with street signs and with cities in Louisiana and Mississippi. I mean, things were called things. And this place was called bolbancha. And the definition of bolbancha is a place of many tongues, which I also love because it still rings so true to this place.
Yeah.
And it was called that because there were over 40 different native tribes that crisscrossed this whole area, trading and living and working. And bolbancha was the name until French people came and called it New Orleans. So I learned that in 2018 and I had, you know, what you're describing of this, just like, what? Like, what? And that was how I thought we should end the series, which was kind of this like ultimate mic drop.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to say.
You know, we spent the past 3 years talking about New Orleans history, you know, in the shadow of the tricentennial, knowing that this was a big, 2018 was a big anniversary year for the city, and that was the impetus for the show. Mm-hmm. And then the last episode kind of says in, you know, hopefully a productive and loving way, like, F all that. That's right. All BS. And this place was a place, like, 300 years of what? And what about the 3,000 years that this place has a history of, you know, before 1718? And so the final episode, it features many different Native and Indigenous people that are from this area that share their perspectives on that and also share personal experiences of what it's like to be Native in 2018.
I was a little behind. I listened to it in 2019, and I had so many questions. It was like, oh my, what must it be like as a podcaster who has named the thing Tripod? And then all of a sudden this gets dropped in your face and you're interviewing people who are like 300, 3,000, right? It was, it's a great episode. It is definitely sort of a mic drop moment for a podcast. It's like, because again, I've grown up here and had never heard the term.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you and I are in the vast majority in that regard.
Yes.
And yet here we sit right now. We're two blocks from Chapultepec Street.
Yeah.
Right. And all New Orleanians know and appreciate the language that makes it unique here, things like that. You and I both did things with the Historic New Orleans Collection about their wonderful exhibit about the founding era. And there was quite a bit there about the Native peoples. And I don't think that term was anywhere in the exhibit.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's... if you weren't intrigued before about Tripod, that alone is worth it. As someone that listened to, I think, every episode, it was sort of a stunning end. But really, again, much like you're saying about Haiti, kind of makes you stop and think. And that's one of the things I love about the reporting you do and about being a podcaster focused on New Orleans is there are so many layers, and the deeper you go, the more there is. Mm-hmm. So you never finish uncovering.
Right.
And so that's kind of maybe an interesting segue to say you finish that, and then you go in what, at least at first glance, appears to be a very different, although I think not so much, direction. So, Sticky Wicket, tell us a little bit. First of all, so there's so many things. Sticky Wicket, first of all, let's talk about how the name came about, because I read that was really as a result of a conversation.
Yeah, yeah. I love, just one thing I'll say is that one of the best parts about calling this show Sticky Wicket is hearing all the names people call it instead of Sticky Wicket.
Okay.
There's just like a long list of people being like, oh, I just heard, I loved Snippity Whippet. Like, it was is so great. You know, just like, I've been trying to keep like a list of the unbelievable inventions of and possibilities of what Sticky Wicket could actually be called. So interestingly, the series has nothing to do with England or sports or cricket, but the term Sticky Wicket derives from the English game of cricket. It's some, you know, mm-hmm. sports term of when, you know, kind of like a pickle in baseball. It's this term in the game when you're kind of in like a tricky situation. And I think it's become a highly uncommon American idiom. So a lot of people haven't heard it before. I hadn't really heard it before. But for the first episode, I was interviewing this scholar named Alicia Long, who's an incredible scholar, writer, historian, about Huey Long. Mm-hmm. They are not related to each other, as she
was clear about that.
Was very clear about. And she was talking about Huey Long, the former governor of Louisiana and U.S. senator, and his relationship to the media. Her description was, you know, that Huey Long was this huge figure who was this media hound. He loved being in the spotlight. He made news. He was also problematic. And you know, there were totalitarian and fascist elements of his governing, despite his highly democratic and even socialist policy platforms. It was this real kind of confusing guy, if you think about him in today's terms. But she said, you know, Huey Long was, you know, lying and shutting down newspapers and really causing problems. But what was the media to do? The media can't just ignore him. They have to cover him because he is important. He is a politician. And so there's this real sticky wicket between someone like Huey Long and the press, because you don't want to cover him to give him more of a platform, but you can't ignore him because he's doing things and he has power. And that just made me think, like, wow, that sounds kind of familiar to what we're seeing right now in 2019 with the president of the United States. So when she said that, I just kept thinking sticky wicket. Like, it's a term you kind of can't get out of your head, mm-hmm. Even if you don't know what it means. But she was using it to perfectly describe the point of the series, which was to show the necessary but complicated relationship between politicians and journalists, and politics and the press as these two pillars in our democracy that are often at odds with each other, but need each other at the same time.
Mm. And so was it, so for our listeners, Sticky Wicket had four episodes. Was that by design, that it was just going to be a four episode?
Yeah, that was by design. We always knew we were going to do, I mean, it's potentially a season one, like, you know,
sure, right.
but we wanted to experiment with this format of a mini series. So I had been doing Tripod for 3 years and we thought, you know, what if we just did, you know, kind of blitzed everybody and dropped this four part thing that you could binge, which I loved because it was nice to start something and finish something in 6 months.
Right. As a podcaster, if you don't have seasons, there's never a break.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I did actually binge all of them on one road trip, like a day trip. I had to go up to Shreveport and listen to them all in one swell.
Wow.
So it's a four-part series. You guys cover Huey Long and Jim Garrison, the former district attorney during the Kennedy assassination. And Dutch Moriel, the first African-American mayor of New Orleans. His son later became mayor of New Orleans. And then my favorite in many respects was Kathleen Blanco, because you talk quite a bit. Kathleen Blanco was the first female governor of Louisiana. She had the misfortune, if you will, although I don't know. I think she has a slightly different take on that. She was the governor during Katrina. Side note for me, I went to USL where her husband was the president when I was there, many years ago when it was USL in Lafayette. But it was interesting to hear your discussion with Kathleen Blanco about how it was dealing with and trying to get help and the perception of her and her administration in those days of Katrina.
Yeah.
Was it as striking for you to hear her talk about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, what stands out the most about that episode amongst the group is that Kathleen Blanco is the only living politician of the four. And so, you know, I do an episode about Huey Long and I can get a lot of people to talk about him, but I can't talk to him.
Right.
And the same goes for Jim Garrison and Dutch Moriel. Kathleen Blanco is here. Mm-hmm. And I knew that, you know, for us to do an episode about her, with her still, you know, living here and being based in Lafayette, I had to make sure that she wanted to talk for this episode to work. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when we found out, you know, reached out to her and she said, yeah, sure, come to my house. And I was like, okay, this is happening. And it was a real pleasure talking to her. I have to say I had never met her before. Mm-hmm. And she invited my producer and I into her home, and we hung out with her for 3 hours in her living room with her husband, who's quite a character. And she jumped right in to 2005 like it was yesterday. And it's interesting because she hasn't done that much talking about this time in her life. She hasn't done that much talking about her single term as the only female governor of the state. But I guess she was ready. Mm-hmm. And it felt like it was the right place at the right time. And she was all in, you know. I had plenty of questions, but it's almost like I didn't even need to ask because she was raring to go. And that, I didn't know what to expect. I drove up there to Lafayette feeling like I have no idea what's going to happen. And what happened was a really fascinating conversation with someone who really seemed eager to kind of get her word out about this, you know, once and for all.
I think, so again, we're talking about Sticky Wicket. And again, we'll put links to all that. I, I loved all four of them. There were enough similarities, but yet differences. It's longer form than what we had gotten from you, obviously, in Tripod. But as a New Orleanian and someone whose family, like so many families here, was so greatly affected by Katrina, I think there was a pretty popular and immediate feeling that Governor Blanco didn't do a good job. But through the discussion that you had with her, it really allowed you, at least for me as a listener, to hear the nuances of, one, the whole idea of Sticky Wicket and the way the media portrayed her, rightfully or wrongly. And then also you had a discussion with a couple of members of the media who now sort of say, gosh, maybe we weren't so fair to her. And that whole discussion, hearing what happened at the time, as well as their reflections and her reflections today, I just thought was a fascinating way to look. If you're interested in knowing more about Katrina, listening to that episode gives you a whole different layer than you get in most any other source I've seen.
Yeah. Well, thanks for saying that. That's interesting to hear. I mean, I think, you know, when you learn from her directly and you hear from her communications director, Bob Mann, and you hear from a male and a female reporter, Jarvis DeBerry and Stephanie mm-hmm. Grace, who are now at NOLA.com, Times-Picayune, and The Advocate, respectively, all talk about the ways in which, you know, Kathleen Blanco, first of all, did a better job than she gets credit for, but also was so roadblocked, and half of what, you know, she potentially wasn't able to accomplish or couldn't do was outside forces. And then on top of that, there being very little appreciation at the time, which is understandable, for the fact that, and I'll always remember Bob Mann, her former communications director, saying this, like, who could have done something really well? Mm-hmm. Who could have, he talked about the difference between a disaster and a catastrophe. And he was like, he said, Katrina was a catastrophe. Who was going to be in power and make that not a catastrophe in the first few weeks and months? And I just think that that's a really interesting and important point. A lot of the episode talks about how Kathleen Blanco showed her emotion on her sleeve and, mm-hmm. you know, looked like she was crying sometimes and looked exhausted. And I just think, you know, people now with some hindsight and also, you know, because so many people were affected personally, also having some time to heal from whatever trauma was happening in that time as well, to say, okay, well, what is so wrong with that? Like, she's a person and she cared about what was happening because it was horrible. And I think that at the time, she was just like very viciously attacked for that, as opposed to thinking like, maybe this isn't a bad thing. Like, why does a leader have to show no emotion? Why does that mean they're a better leader? So I think it was just, it's an episode about Katrina, but it's an episode about optics, and it's an episode about sexism, and it's an episode about how the media portrays disasters and what effect that has on the audience.
For me, it was such a synopsis both of where we are at this moment in time in 2019, but also a synopsis of the four episodes. All these little angles, the sticky wickets, right? Something seems so clear on the surface, but it's really not. And there's a, do you ignore it? And if you ignore it, where's your responsibility? It also struck me that that's an interview that would have been very different even 2, 3, 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that discussion, again, if you did it 5 years from now, it would be yet again. Now, and she's battling a very serious incurable cancer right now, too. But it's the lens of this moment in time that was really interesting. I also think, shifting just a little bit, as you mentioned, the other three are all deceased, but you did talk to Dutch Moriel's widow.
Yeah.
And to hear her perspective of that time, and then also raising a future mayor, and the things that they taught their kids and even grandkids today about life as an African American, as a Creole, here in New Orleans and here in Louisiana in the United States. It's just a fascinating kind of back and forth, and again, those layers.
Yeah. And like you're saying, the parallels between something that happened, you know, 15 years ago or 40 years ago, you know, the episode about Dutch Moriel, where I got to talk to Sybil Moriel, she talked about, you know, she was really honest and blunt about what she told her children about what it was like to be Black and live in the South. And, you know, that talk that that people have of, you know, you can't do this and you have to do everything twice as well. Don't wear a hoodie. Don't run. Don't fight back. If the police come, just, you know, like that whole rhetoric that people have to learn, that's just so horrible about having to move through the world in this different way because of the color of your skin. And what she said later was, you know, I had to tell my children that, and I'd say the exact same thing to my grandchildren. So I just thought that was so telling and such a way to show, here's another generation, here's 20 years or 30 years, and this single individual, the mayor's wife, is having the same conversation about being Black in the South.
Yeah. And so this episode that you and I are recording today will be released in the middle of February in 2019. We're in the midst of Carnival too. So I won't spoil all that because I want people to go back and listen. But that episode, as you hear this one, you should stop this and then go listen to that because it also has a Carnival and Mardi Gras twist.
Yeah.
Which most New Orleanians know, but if you're not from here, you probably don't. And there's a lot of overlapping stories there too. So again, I thought it was fascinating because of all the different levels. So I want to segue into what's next, but while I toss that at you, I do want to pay the bills a little bit if I can.
Yeah, go for it.
You know, you came here and you fell in love with the city, and you know, people, that happens a lot. And when that happens, Lane, you know, you need a realtor. You need somebody to come help you. And so I actively sought out a realtor as a sponsor because one of the questions, people come, they take Christine's tours, they listen to me, maybe they listen to your podcast, maybe they come to Tulane, they fall in love, and then they want to stay or they want to move here. And you need somebody to help navigate, as you've learned, just like probably growing up in New York. New Orleans is full of neighborhoods, and it's a pretty complicated thing when you start to try to figure out, well, where should I live? Should I live in mid-city or uptown or downtown or the Ninth Ward or the Treme? There's a lot of little subtext to it, and you got to figure that out. And my friend Liz over at Lizwood Realty helps you do that. She and her team make it fun and also kind of help you navigate what to expect and what's a good match for you, whether you're looking to buy or rent. And we have a really active Facebook group, the Beyond Bourbon Street Crew. Several people there have been able to get Liz's help. So when she came to me, it just seemed like a great partnership. She makes it really easy. When you're ready to move to New Orleans, reach out to her at lizwoodrealty.com and you can make your dream of living in New Orleans true, just like you and me. And again, lots of people have done that and they've enjoyed it. But for you, so what comes next after Sticky Wicket? Do you know?
Great question. That is what I'm working on right now. A friend just advised that I refer to this phase that I'm in as my development phase, which is the probably most professional way of putting it. The Sticky Wicket and Tripod both ended at the end of the year. I am very busy right now for the next month and a half actively building a Tripod website because the beauty of this show is that it's evergreen, as we say in the industry, meaning that even if you've never heard of Tripod, and I'm telling you right now that the show ended, it's a blessing for me, and I think for the content, that has nothing to do with whether or not you want to go back and listen. The active shelf life of Tripod has nothing to do with it being in production. These are all episodes that, you know, don't expire.
Right, it's not a This Week in New Orleans.
No, it's history. Yeah. And history, as we continue to see, only continues to present itself in today and have relevance. And so there's no website currently. I mean, if you go to WWNO, that website has this very straightforward, just kind of like link where you can see all the episodes as they aired. But we're building a website to be able to really catalog the archive of these stories so that when you go to tripodnola.com at the, you know, end of March, you'll be able to search for episodes. You'll be able to search by category. And so you can say, okay, I'm interested in, you know, seeing what you have on sports in New Orleans. I'm interested in seeing what you have on immigration in New Orleans. I'm interested in seeing what you have on Native American history in New Orleans. And it will be a way more accessible tool to access the archive. And we're also creating an educational element to the site where, you know, I've learned as I've made the show over the past few years that a lot of educators, whether it's, you know, elementary school all the way through graduate programs, have been using Tripod in the classroom, which is really exciting, mm-hmm. and taking episodes and kind of building curriculums and units around them. So now we're doing a call out to teachers. And if you're a teacher and you've used Tripod, hit me up to say, hey, if you've used Tripod in the classroom, talk to us because we want to post those units on the website and make them free to download so that we become an educational resource that has built-in tools for you to take and just use in the classroom. So all of that is what I'm focusing on right now, a little break from actually making radio mm-hmm. and creating an ongoing digital tool that will keep Tripod alive, you know, for years to come.
Well, and I saw maybe a Facebook post on your personal page recently about that, about the tie into education. And it really speaks to the power of podcasting too. One, that it's an intimate way and it's to connect with people and that you can consume it, whether it's the drive time. I mean, that's a great thing about dropping in public radio. But if you miss that, if that's not your drive time, right, or you have the kids or whatever it might be, you can consume it in little snippets in whatever else you're doing. Which to me is, as opposed to the video aspect where you have to be fair, you can't be driving the car watching video, but you can ride your bike or walk or do those things with it. What's the best way for people to get in touch with you if they want to?
So I am on Twitter, so you can tweet at me at Lane Kaplev. And you can also email me if you, you know, have an idea of something that you think, you know, the station should focus on next. If you, again, are an educator that has used Tripod or wants to use Tripod in your classroom, email me. My email address is Lane, which is LAINE at WWNO.org. So, you know, if you can follow me on Twitter, you can follow Tripod and Sticky Wicket on Instagram. Sticky Wicket is Sticky Wicket Pod and Tripod is Tripod Nola. And you can subscribe to both of those wherever you listen to podcasts. So if you listen on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Google Play or NPR One, all of that stuff, both of those are up there. We're thinking about doing more with Sticky Wicket. I can't say right now.
Sure.
In, you know, what iteration that will take. But in addition to the website, I am thinking about what type of project we can do next.
And we'll put all the links to the ways they can listen to the show and they can connect with you our site. But I'll tell you, as I was talking to people about doing this interview, lots of people have lots of ideas. And I know you put out kind of a call for that on your Facebook page. And so, you know, if you have an idea or something, it's the same thing that happened to me, right? People have an idea. What people don't realize is a lot of those ideas do germinate. And you go, there's a twist there that would be fascinating to dive into.
Yeah.
So people should do that. And you and I have been talking about visiting the city. My hotel sponsor, if you will, is the old number 77 hotel. Have you ever been over there?
I have.
So the old 77 is fabulous in so many ways. But it's in the Warehouse District, first of all. Longtime listeners know this. It's only a few blocks from the French Quarter. I like the proximity. I like being out of the quarter, but three blocks away. I like that you're right near both the St. Charles and the Canal Street streetcar lines. But one of the things I love that comes to mind as I'm sitting here with a fellow creator is they really focus on creators and artists and makers. So they have this wonderful little pop-up seasonal art gallery that's just a long hallway, but it's done by the folks over at Where Your Art, which I had to get them on at some point to talk about their lens on New Orleans and how they showcase artists. But the old 77 focuses on that. They sell crafts from local artists and artisans. We were talking before we came on. Our friend Patty Dunn over at Chop Industries makes these great bags. They sell them there. Mm-hmm. We've interviewed Mandy from Nola Boards. They sell her cutting boards there. Sweet Olive Soaps. So lots of little things. And I like that about they're a hotel, they're a place where you stay, but you really get a sense of New Orleans and a flavor, even down to the level of the products they sell. They have wonderful rooms. So you and I don't need this, but if you are out and you're visiting, they have rooms with no windows, which I think New Orleans is the one place where that's pretty good, right? If you've been out enjoying the French Quarter a bit, right? Yeah. You might not want windows. They have a lot of different kinds of rooms. They have rooms that are decorated, as you and I sit in this beautiful room here at Grigri, rooms decorated by local artists. So there's just a lot of choice. The other thing, and I am frequently there for business, they have great cocktails and great appetizers to go with those cocktails. So there's a whole lot there. If I've whet your appetite for it, check them out. You can. They're located at 535 Chapultepec Street. But if you use code BBOLD77 when you book, you'll save 25%. Plus, they give you some credit at their coffee shop downstairs. So if you need something to get you going in the morning. But they are wonderful over there at the old number 77 hotel. So I wonder, Lane, as we wrap up, it seems like you, all of your interests have come together in sort of a disparate, like a way you probably couldn't have predicted in 2008 or 2009.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
What do you think about having spent all of these years now here in New Orleans, when you go back to New York, do you feel does it feel similar or very different, the two communities?
Very different.
Yeah.
Very, very different. I would say my family started noticing, this is kind of cliche, but it's true. My family, I would go home and we would all go on a walk and they were all like telling me how slow I walk and that I'm just, how slow I talk. And, you know, all of those things about the pace of New York versus New Orleans is so real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you get acclimated to this place. And I think people that stay and choose it is because it fits your preference and your own personal internal pace. And I think what I feel fortunate about is the fact that I've been able to find a rigorous profession and be able to work really hard in this city and also have that relaxed vibe that's a little bit removed from like American capitalism, like just a little bit, but more removed than if I were in a place like New York where it's just living, breathing that type of priority and drive. So I think that, you know, what I feel lucky to have is a job here that I feel really motivated to do and work hard and stay busy, but also have that slow pace to balance it with. And when you go to New York, which I love, I don't know if people have that.
Yeah. I was in New York for the Saints-Giants game earlier this year and was reminded of that very thing. People do work hard here, despite maybe the moniker.
Yes.
But we also enjoy life here and slow down and celebrate. And I think the best way to enjoy New Orleans for visitors is to just slow down, as if you were in a European city and sitting at a cafe and letting it come to you a little bit.
Yeah.
And you can have the both of best of both of those things.
Yeah, yeah.
Lane, it was such a treat to have you on.
It was great. Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
This has been, again, really great. We will put links to Tripod, to Sticky Wicket, and ways to connect with you over in the show notes at beyondbourbonst.com/83. You'll also find links to our sponsors, The Old 77, Liz Wood Realty, and Two Chicks Walking Tours. And be sure to use those discount codes so you save a little bit of money. Thanks again to Grigri for hosting us here. Again, a beautiful spot. I'm going to throw a couple pictures up on social media, but make sure you consider it. It's a great place to have lunch or dinner, or when the weather's nice like it is this afternoon in just a little while, have drinks outside on the wraparound balcony. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the show, please share it with someone who loves New Orleans as much as you and me and Lane. And until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.